Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. We've got a lot on the program today. In just a moment, my rant today from Hartman Report. Why do Americans trust Davos man to run the economy or to run our nation, for that matter? What's up with that? This is not a political party. This is a cult. Nearly 70% of registered Republicans now say that they want Congress to impeach Biden if Republicans take back the House after the midterms. And also, Peter Fajkowski will be with us. Can trillions of tons of excess CO2 be actually removed from our atmosphere? He just wrote a new book about this. And also, the Bank of England is now warning about apocalyptic global food shortages that could begin in as little as a few months as a result of the Russian embargo. They're blocking the shipping from Ukraine, from Ukrainian ports, of grain to Africa and the Middle East. To start out our program, though, I'm going to get into this. Why is it that Americans don't get what we want out of our political system? You know, the majority of Americans would like Social Security strengthened, would like the minimum wage raised to $15, would like everybody to have the right to unionize, would like free college and a national health care system like Canada has or like pretty much every country in Europe has. But we don't get this stuff, even though the majority of us want it, and the majority of us actually vote for it. Why don't we get it? Well, you know, we've got basically Davos man running the nation. Davos, Switzerland is hosting the Davos, you know, the World Economic Forum this week. And the morbidly rich and their factotums, their toadies, their bureaucratic and wholly owned politicians and media are showing up in Switzerland to celebrate great wealth. Their theme is history at a turning point. And, you know, it's like, why do we have this fascination with this? Elon Musk just tweeted that he's dumping the Democratic Party and he's going to stick with the Republicans now. So what? But this has like become big news, right? Well, the so what is that he's the richest man in the world. He could buy as many politicians as he wants, and he could have them do whatever he wants because the Supreme Court authorized that with Citizens United. Bill Gates is invited on to talk show hosts all the time to opine about education and contagious diseases when his only claim to fame is that he bought an operating system and sold it to IBM and made a fortune. Somebody else's operating system at that. Howard Schultz tried to become president of the United States. Remember that? He's back to union busting at Starbucks. And Jeff Bezos is now tweeting politics, too, causing some people to wonder if, you know, he's on various days the second richest man in the world, causing people to wonder if, like, billionaire Donald Trump or billionaire Mitt Romney or billionaire Mike Bloomberg, billionaire Jeff Bezos is the next guy to get into politics. You know, whether it's those guys, you know, on the, you know, being right up at the front, whether it's people who aren't not quite billionaires but are close, like, you know, the hedge fund, you know, like J.D. Vance in Ohio or David McCormick in Georgia, you know, these hedge fund multimillionaires, maybe 100 millionaires, or whether it's the people playing in the background, like the Kochs and the DeVos family, you know, who just pour money into politics. It's like a hobby for them that was legalized by the Supreme Court. Why? Why do we tolerate this? What's going on with Americans' embrace of rich people running our political system for their own benefit and to the detriment of the majority of Americans? Why do we put up with this? Why is it that we even seem to love it? I mean, how can this be? Well, it turns out that it all has to do, in a way, with religion, even a scientific aspect of religion. First of all, you know, starting about 1,500 years ago in Europe, you had kings who would rise to power through violence and then declare that God put them there. I mean, the coins in British coins today, many of them, have an inscription, Elizabeth II, D-G-R-E-G-F-D, which stands for Dea Gratia Regina Fidei Defensor, which roughly translates into she rules Britain and defends the faith by the grace of God. The grace of God? Really? I mean, the American version of this came to the United States in the 1700s, in the 1600s, actually, as a result of John Calvin, who in the 1500s founded what is today called the Calvinist, you know, the Calvinistic religion. I'm not certain of its actual formal name, but Calvin asserted that, And he based this on a biblical quote from Ephesians 1:4-6, you know, that and Calvin loved to quote this, that Jesus had been chosen before the foundation of the world by God, and that all of us are. In other words, Calvin believed in predestination, that you're doomed or saved before you are even born. So And that pretty much everybody, the vast majority of us anyway, because we come into this world through a woman, we're contaminated by that woman in us, and thus we carry original sin. And so Calvin said, you know, well, basically there's some people that God wants to rule the world, right? You know, some people that God loves. You can find that throughout the Bible. God loved David, right, for example, King David. So how do we figure out who these people that God loves are, so we can put them in charge of things? This was the big challenge in the 1500s in England. John Calvin, I think, was French, maybe, or Swiss, whatever he was. In any case, his answer was, God tells you who he wants to run things by who he makes rich. Rich people should run things. Now, you know, that was the religious shtick, and it's been used by kings and emperors and all kinds of people ever since. The modern version of this is using science, essentially, as if it was a religion. And this is what we follow in the United States. William F. Buckley and George Will talking about, you know, this secular version of Calvinism, saying that basically those with the best DNA should rule the world. And how do you know who has the best DNA? Well, they're the ones who are smart enough to get rich. Oh, hey, we're right back where John Calvin was. We've just replaced God with DNA. And this was actually a big deal. I mean, this goes back to the 1840s. Herbert Spencer, in 1842, wrote a treatise called The Proper Sphere of Government, in which he made this argument, saying that government should never provide poor people with education or health care because they got bad genes and you don't want them to breed, and that government should be guided by people who had the best genes. His ideas were picked up by Francis Galton 25 years later, who in 1869 wrote a book, Hereditary Genius, An Inquiry into Laws and Its Laws and Consequences, and said that we should be actually sterilizing or even killing defective, in quotes, or substandard people. Winston Churchill embraced eugenics. He tried to get it into law in England in 1912. He was rebuffed by Parliament. Here in the United States, American President Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, picked up eugenics and promoted it heavily in the United States. We had posters arguing that the sterilization should happen. It was so successful that by the 1940s, every state in the Union had eugenics laws and allowed involuntary sterilization of people, particularly Native Americans and people who were mentally ill or mentally retarded, is the old phrase, intellectually challenged, whatever we call it today. Adolf Hitler, of course, picked up on Churchill and Wilson's slogans almost verbatim and used eugenics as his rationale for what became the Holocaust. But even the Holocaust didn't cause Americans' political right to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be looking at DNA as who should be running our country. George Will, writing about how, you know, if everybody voted in America, quote, as indifferent or reluctant voters are nagged to the polls or someday prodded there by a monetary penalty for not voting, he's talking about like how it works in Australia, he says, the caliber of the electorate must decline. Right. You know, this nation was founded on the rejection of a hereditary aristocracy. We said no to kings. We would be wise to return to that precept that the will of the people rather than the will of the rich must determine public policy. I'll take a Joe Biden or a Bernie Sanders, or frankly, even a Liz Cheney any day over a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk determining American public policy. Wisdom, insight, experience, understanding of the consequences of policy, a deep grounding in the history of the United States and democratic institutions around the world. I see almost none of those things among our billionaire class who want to insert themselves into politics. But many of our politicians actually understand this stuff. You know, the preamble to the Constitution says that, you know, this Constitution was created to promote the general welfare of the United States. General, not the welfare of the billionaires, the general welfare of the United States. And before the Reagan Revolution, before 1980, that's what we did. We got Social Security, we got Medicare, we got a national highway system, we got hospitals, we got the best school, primary elementary schools in the world, we got NASA, we got debt-free college, we got a unionized middle class, all that stuff before Reagan. And then the Reagan Revolution came along, and for the last 42 years, we have been taking advice from and allowing our country to be run by billionaires. And how's it working out for you? Frankly, I think that only when American government is again run by politicians who put working class Americans first can actual popular policies, policies that more than half of Americans say they want, you know, a national health care system, debt-free college, well-funded public schools, a clean environment, just basic stuff. We're only going to get it when we stop kowtowing to and sucking up to and electing billionaires and their factotums and their toadies to politics. Frankly, I think the way to get there is to overturn Citizens United, but you know, just calling it out is a good place to start. By the way, that was my rant from HartmanReport.com today. Why do Americans trust Davos man to run the nation? Jim in Rochester, New York. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon from the East Coast, Tom.
Well, thank you, Jim.
I was listening online, Democracy Now! Chevron had a $6 billion first quarter profit. What is it going to take to get the folks in Congress to drag the people that run the oil companies in, just like we did a few decades back, and ask them what the heck is going on here?
Well, they did that in front of O'Connor's committee just last year. And the guys just kind of sneered and you know, fed them slick platitudes, and it was very frustrating.
That sounds like typical oil executives BS. What's it going to take to pull the subsidies out from underneath them? And also, what's it going to take for Joe Biden to decide, if you guys don't do something about these oil prices, we're going to mandate price controls?
Yeah.
And nobody's going to want that. But he's got to scare them into bringing their prices down. Last week, I heard you say it's costing, I don't know, somewhere in the under $30 a barrel to pull oil out of the ground.
Right, in the United States.
And thanks to the legislation, let them sell it on the international market, we're all running around with Preparation H.
Yeah.
What's it going to take to fix this, you think?
I think it's smarter than I am. It's going to take the election to Congress of a majority of progressive Democrats. It's just that simple. There have been some good and serious efforts to do something about this. The Build Back Better legislation actually cut back on a lot of those oil industry subsidies, but it was blocked by Kyrsten Sinema because she's openly, proudly taking money from right-wing billionaires now, and by Joe Manchin, who owns a family coal business, which has made him a multimillionaire, and is like in deep with the fossil fuel industry. So we've got a few bad apples in the Democratic Party, and we need to either replace them or outnumber them. And we're seeing this happen in the House. I mean, here in Oregon, I don't know if the final election results are in, but I think we got rid of Kurt Schrader finally. And, it's like step by step. I mean, that's what it's going to take, Jim. So that's, the bottom line is we all need to get active and get out there and get, progressive Democrats elected. Thanks a lot for the call. It was a good one. Ron in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I've been looking at everything realistically. I'm down here in Florida, and on all the major highways, they have digital signs blaming Biden for everything.
Really?
And, the only thing that we have to our advantage is the truth of what's really going on, but we are not pushing it the way we should. And you made a statement earlier about how all the people, not all, but a lot, like the billionaires. It's not so much the billionaires, it's because they're white and billionaires. If they were black and billionaires, they wouldn't like them as well.
I think it's policy more than race. I think the race stuff is huge in America, and it is, being manipulated for political gain constantly. But, billionaires, and maybe not Oprah, but by and large, billionaires are looking out for their own. Their issues have to do with their industries and their personal taxes. That's fine, but frankly, I don't think the rest of us should, have to suffer as a consequence of it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
The president and the Pentagon are doing a little bit of a dance right now. He was, at this conference in Japan and was asked, if China invades Taiwan, will America stand up militarily to protect Taiwan? And this is a question that, we've always been ambiguous about. In fact, ambiguity is literally the policy. And Biden instead simply said yes. He said, that's the commitment we've made, yes. So now the Pentagon's saying, well, he didn't mean yes, but he didn't mean no. Yeah. I'm impressed, I have to say. It was Joe Biden, when he was vice president, who was asked about gay marriage and said, yeah, I'm in favor of it. And I think Obama is, too. He just won't say so. And a week later, Obama said so. And, boom, now we got gay marriage. I mean, there were a whole bunch of steps in there, obviously, but it was a pretty big deal. President Biden has a tendency to speak what he's thinking, to say what he actually believes, and good on him. Whether we should get in a war in Southeast Asia is a whole nother topic that's worth discussing. Whether we should be the only defensive democracies, another topic that's worth discussing. Obviously, Japan is arming themselves insanely rapidly. I mean, like never before, because they've, for 70 years, they've been, where are the peace people? Not anymore. Because of China. So we'll see how this plays out, but I just wanted to flag that for you. Meanwhile, almost 70% of Republican voters, this is a new survey that just came out. This is from the UMass Amherst poll conducted by YouGov. Almost 70% of Republican voters say the House of Representatives should impeach President Biden if their party takes over that chamber in 2022. So this fall, if Republicans take the House of Representatives, 70%, well, 68% is the actual number, 68% of Republican voters, registered Republicans, say impeach Joe Biden. What for? I mean, you're going to impeach him for keeping people alive through the pandemic. You're going to impeach him for encouraging, you know, good union jobs. You're going to impeach him for trying to raise, you know, the minimum wage. You're going to impeach him for ending the COVID crisis by getting, you know, billions of shots into arms across the United States. You're going to impeach him for getting COVID tests in our homes for free. You're going to impeach him for you know, supporting our hospital system during this crisis. You're going to impeach him for cleaning up the mess that Trump left. Impeach him for what? When they asked, 68% of Republicans and Trump voters and 66% of conservatives said they would like to see the president, quote, charged by Congress for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Really? I mean, that's what they went after Trump for. Apparently, they just don't think it's serious what we did when we went after Trump. They don't think that Trump blackmailing Zelensky, which is the first thing he was impeached for, blackmailing Zelensky and saying, or extorting, actually, was, I think is the proper word. Zelensky had a contract with the United States to buy, as I recall, they were Stinger anti-tank missiles, and maybe wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. It was some sort of anti-tank missile. He had a deal with us to buy, I think it was $400 million worth of them, and they were supposed to be shipped to Ukraine, and they never arrived. And Trump invites Zelensky to the White House and says, you want your missiles? Find some dirt on Joe Biden for me. And, you know, when Alexander Vindman heard that phone call, he did the whistleblower routine, and we now know about it, and they impeached Donald Trump for extortion. And I mean, that was a crime. And it should horrify every Republican. And then when Donald Trump encouraged people on January 6th to march down to the Capitol building and take names and kick ass, it wasn't the exact phrase he used, but there was plenty of phraseology that was very similar to it, along with Mo Brooks and his bulletproof vest and John Eastman, the guy who was organizing all the phony electors. And five people died that day. And, you know, the Capitol was desecrated, valuable ancient artwork was damaged, feces were smeared on the walls and the floors. Somebody built a gallows. Now, who built the gallows? We still don't know. Somebody built a gallows. It couldn't have just been one person. That's a hell of a lot of wood. And it was well designed. I mean, somebody knew what they were doing. And they brought all that stuff and they put it together on the lawn of the White House to hang the Vice President of the United States. And then they went looking for him to do it. And Donald Trump was impeached for that. And these people are still saying, well, that was no big deal, but we do want to impeach Joe Biden. For what? Meanwhile, now, speaking of impeachable offenses, and you can impeach presidents who are no longer in office, by the way. What it does is it prevents them from ever running for office. Donald Trump, well, this started out, you know, Lara Logan, the anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist who is now, once worked for CBS, is now a regular on right-wing, you know, the marginal right-wing networks. She had reposted a message from the right-wing president of El Salvador, saying that the United States is falling fast because of an enemy within. Now, she retweets that, and then Donald Trump posts a message retweeting that. Trump reposts that. George, and then and another one calling for civil war. So George Conway says, nothing to see here, just a former president of the United States sharing a social media post advocating or predicting civil war in the United States. No biggie. Former Republican Congressman Denver Riggleman, who was a contractor with the National Security Agency, calls himself a disinformation hunter. He said, Trump mirrors his base. Pay attention. Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Illinois says, tell me how he's never egged on violence again. And Dean Obadala, I'll be on his show this afternoon, by the way, in the 7 o'clock hour Eastern time. My friend and just a great talk show host. Dean says, or Dean writes, quote, to Trump's suggestion of a civil war appears to forget that on January 6th, he and his forces tried that and failed. But the fact Trump can call for civil war today is only possible because the Department of Justice has not prosecuted Trump, despite it being 502 days since January 6th. This was a day or so ago, so it's been a few more days. So what is going on with the Republican Party? As far as I can tell, and, you know, the earlier story that I shared with you about the woman who's suggesting that Nancy Pelosi and President Biden are not actually humans, that they're actually demons. That's the kind of language that is very often precedes murders, particularly in the third world, particularly in theocratic countries. This is not a political party anymore. It's turned into a cult. And it's a cult that, you know, I think is quite dangerous. There's a new study, the Republican Party in the past year, over 100 extremist candidates are up for election as Republicans in this election. They've taken over, by the way, these hardcore right-wing crazies have taken over the party here in Oregon, and they're trying to take it over in a bunch of other states. Same thing in Idaho next door. Republican figures are showing up and speaking at white nationalist gatherings where they applaud Putin and do Sieg Heil, literally Heil Hitlers. I mean, this happened, and Marjorie Taylor Greene gave a speech there right after that. So research institute decided to try and get to the bottom of this. This is the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. And they did a study, and they, you know, how much extremism is happening inside the GOP? What they found, and this is shocking, the 100-plus extremist candidates I mentioned are just at the federal level. If you look at the state level, 875 legislators in all 50 states, constituting nearly 22% of all elected Republican lawmakers, identified as participating members of extremist Facebook groups. This is how they did their analysis. They were looking at these hardcore extremist Facebook groups who are, like, calling for the overthrow of the government of the United States. They identified 789 of these groups on Facebook, and 875 legislators who are proud members of them. They also identified some 963 pieces of legislation, anti-human rights legislation, that have been introduced by these 875 legislators in all 50 states. The states with the highest percentage of extremist legislators were Alaska, 35%, Arkansas, 25%, Idaho, 22%, Montana, 22%, Washington State, 20%, Minnesota, 19%, Maine, 18%, and Missouri, 18%. We've got a problem here. I don't know how to say it beyond that. We have a problem in America with a political party that has been hijacked by religious cults and, frankly, nuts. People who are not mentally well, and they're being celebrated by this party because yes, we love Donald Trump. What do we do about this? Are you encountering these people in your life? How do you deal with them? I got an email that was kind of like this from an old friend. I just ignored it. What do you do? How do you engage with these people? So we, the human race, have been blowing billions of tons of carbon dioxide, perhaps trillions of tons of carbon, into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, you know, for the last roughly 200, 250 years. And can we Can we pull it out? Can a trillion tons of excess CO2 be removed from our atmosphere? There's a fascinating new book out by Peter Fikowski. It's titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. And Peter Fikowski, F-I-E-K-O-W-S-K-Y.com is his website, and P. Fikowski is his Twitter handle. And Peter is on the line with us. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Back at you. Glad to have you with us. So tell us what, you know, when Lila Connors and friends were making this movie, Ice on Fire, that Leo DiCaprio put together, we went to Germany together and we were in Norway together. But in Germany, we visited one of these giant experimental projects where they were extracting carbon from the air and turning it into stone. The problem was that it took a whole lot more carbon to get the carbon out. I mean, you know, the energy ratio was all wrong. We'd burn, you know, thousands I don't know the numbers actually, but you know what I'm saying.
So, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
So how do we do this? How do we actually extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in a way that is net carbon neutral?
Well, you know, what's fun about this, I love having written the book and talking about it because it's very good news. What's new about it is that if you set the goal of restoring the climate, the methods for doing it start jumping out at you. And so we have, you know, the first question is like, well, wait a minute, if it's that easy, why haven't we been doing it before? And the answer is our goal was to reduce emissions. Which was fine in 1970. Today, our goal has to be to restore the climate. Now, to get the trillion tons out, we're going to end up doing the same thing that nature does. You and your listeners know that we have ice ages periodically on our planet, and that nature takes out a trillion tons of CO2 before each ice age, and so we can do the same thing, and. Then that's one method I'll tell you about. And then a second method is over hundreds of millions of years, our planet sequesters all of our carbon, almost all of it is limestone. 99% is limestone on the bottom of the ocean, which is old seashells and so on. Mm-hmm. And so, we can also duplicate that and do that very rapidly.
Okay, so and how do we do this, Peter?
Go ahead.
So how do we do this?
Well, if we do the sort of the ice age thing, which is the fast way, then nature stores the carbon in the ocean. If you think about ocean as blue, that's beautiful, but it's not green. Green is when you have algae and you have photosynthesis happening.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
You And the difference between blue ocean and green ocean, most of the ocean is a little bit of iron. It's a critical nutrient required in incredibly small amounts. And normally it gets blown in as dust. Now, occasionally it used to be that whales would pull it up from the bottom, but we killed off 95% of the whales. And so our ocean has been turning bluer and bluer, and we've been sequestering less and less CO2. And so it's been demonstrated that we can spread dust, much as a volcano spreads dust with iron, or a dust storm from the Sahara. And that dust provides the iron and then sequesters a lot of CO2. And
I remember reading about this 30 years ago, you know, the idea that we could spray very, very tiny iron filings, essentially, or, you know, at almost a molecular level, particles of iron.
Iron dust. Yeah.
Right, yeah, across the ocean. And, you know, it would provide food for plants, and those plants would extract carbon from the water that had been absorbed from the air. And that carbon would become the body of the plants. And then over time, those plants would die and settle to the bottom of the ocean, or they would become food for animals that sequester that carbon in their shells, as you pointed out, and become ultimately limestone. But my understanding was that the early experiments on that were pretty ambiguous about whether, you know, it could be done or if it could even be done at scale. Yes. Has something new happened I'm unaware of?
Nothing terribly new. The main issue, the problem wasn't the science. The problem was the politics. And the UN has been telling us that we have to reduce emissions. And so politically, the organizations which were demonstrating this, they call it the iron hypothesis, or iron fertilization. The groups that were doing it were pushed back by the environmentalists, who said, listen, the UN tells us we need to reduce emissions. If we reduce CO2 levels as much as you're saying, we're not going to be able to motivate people to stop driving cars. Right. So you got to stop pulling the CO2 out. And so,
which actually makes sense. I mean, you know, if you're hitting yourself in the head with a hammer, you stop hitting yourself with a hammer before you take the aspirin.
Well, look at politics. Politics, unfortunately, doesn't work that way. It became a political issue, right, not a scientific issue. Right. And, you know, and so what I've done here is saying that really this is about the survival and flourishing of humanity. And said, you know, and once you accept that we need to do it, then you say, how do we do it? 10 years ago, a test was done in the Gulf of Alaska, and they demonstrated that they grew a phenomenal amount of plankton and algae and a lot of fish. There's very good evidence they got a lot of CO2 out. The evidence said it was almost 100 million tons in that one test with about 70 tons of iron dust.
Wow.
Yeah. And
no externalities, no negative consequences.
No. Very positive.
It's like fertilizing a garden, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. The salmon harvest in Alaska the following year was four times what it had been.
Huh. So why have they not? Why aren't they doing this every year? Why hasn't this grown?
Well, the politics scared everybody off. And a number of us have been promoting it the last few years. And it looks like, you know, there's an academic group that's beginning to plan and search for money to do academic testing. And there are at least one commercial group, the one that did the work in Alaska. Right. They're also working.
The scale, though, here, Peter, is I mean, you know, the oceans are massive. I mean, it's, you know, there's far more ocean surface on the planet than there is land. And you know, if you're going to dig up, you know, tons and tons of iron ore and refine out of that the iron, and obviously that's going to produce a lot of CO2 just in that process, and then transport it and then grind it, you know, pulverize it and then transport it to an ocean and then dump it on the ocean. You know, I could see, you know, 1,000 airplanes a day pouring stuff on the ocean and not even making a dent. And, well, you know, when we're talking about billions or hundreds of billions of tons of carbon, or am I missing something here?
Yeah, yeah. The amount of iron is about a millionth of a part per million, or a few millionths of a part per million. So it's a phenomenally small amount of iron. Hmm. The story is that in 1990, the scientists who finally figured it out, and it was very hard to figure out because the amount of iron is so low that it wasn't until the late 80s they could even measure such a small amount. Anyway, so he went to a meeting and he said, listen, if you give me half a tanker of iron, I'll give you the next ice age. And everyone sort of shook in their seats thinking, oh my God, that probably is true, that it's that really? Concentrated. Wow. And so I was on a meeting with the academics yesterday, and they were saying, well, you know, probably two 747s could do the whole thing.
Wow. That's I'm skeptical, but that's mind-boggling. We're talking with Peter Fiakowski. He's got a new book out. It's called Climate Restoration: The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. Peter, I'm going to hit a break here in a minute, and but very quickly, what other ways can we restore the climate besides fertilizing our ocean?
Yeah. So the other really great way is synthetic limestone. So if you think of an oyster and with its shell, it's very low energy. There's a company here in California, which makes synthetic limestone. So it does the same process that...
You mean they're pulling the carbon out of the atmosphere to make the limestone?
Right, right. And then it's a $1 trillion market. And for the rock, and we
use that through a catalytic process.
Yeah. Huh. Just like an oyster. I mean, similar, but it's different.
Right.
But again, it was never needed before, and so the developer of it said, you know what, this is the best way, second to ocean fertilization. This is the best way to get a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere.
So there are strategies to restore our climate, and the book is by Peter Fiakowski, Fiekowski. Titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. Peter, thanks for dropping by today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for talking.
My pleasure. Okay. Your book deserves a wider audience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, the Bank of England is warning of apocalyptic food shortages. We'll cover that, and then I'll pick up your phone calls on the other side of this. Tim in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon. Calling you from the armpit of America, District 11, Madison Cawthorn's district.
Oh, my.
Well, you know, I told you, I don't know if you remember this, but I've known Madison for many, many years. We've fought together in the same dojo as he was growing up. And way back when, I was going to run against him, but a good friend of mine, Eric Gash, chose to run, but he pulled out a month prior to the primaries. And of course, I'm the one that talks to the opossums and wildlife, been a wildlife artist for 40 years. But now I am for replacement theory, by the way. I totally believe in it. I believe we should replace every conservative Republican with a real American-loving Democrat based on FDR's social progress. So, yeah, I'm for replacement theory. Okay. Let's get them all out of here.
Yeah, I get
but
it.
What I wanted to talk to you about was if you go back and look at the 1968 William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal debate, mm-hmm. people will see, and that's a very interesting ideas that come from there. People will see that they were discussing the very same things that we are predicating all of the hate and vitriol and control and privatization. That was all being discussed back then. And you know, a lot of the arguments that Buckley posed, and of course, without Buckley, you'd have no Rush Limbaugh. And by the way, without Black Entertainment Television (BET), you'd have Fox News. Fox News would not exist, in my opinion. I can't prove this, but when BET reached, I think it was 18 million, 19 million subscribers, that's when Fox News came on board. And I believe that it was. Somebody should really kind of research that, because to me it was some sort of a, you know.
I think what you're looking at, Tim, is niche marketing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that on a good week, you know, the top Fox shows will have 3 million viewers. That's not a lot of Americans out of a country of 330 million people.
This was back in the 90s, early 90s.
No, no, I get that. But I think
started in the 80s.
Right. So if BET demonstrated that, you know, okay, niche marketing can be very, very profitable. You don't have to go for the big mass market. You can identify a segment of the market, in this case, black people that you're going to market to and make money. Then, you know, Rupert Murdoch comes along. He spent his whole life marketing to white right-wing racists. And says, well, hey, maybe I can make money marketing to white right-wing racists. I'm assuming that's the essence of what you're arguing here.
Absolutely. But go back and look at the Buckley-Vidal debate in 1968. Right. And I want to leave you with a couple of other things. We can prove, why are Democrats, why do they lack cojones in doing anything? I mean, why can't we prosecute? Why can't we do what the Black Panthers did? I mean, I'm not advocating violence. But I sure as heck am advocating every minority own a gun and display it and show it, just like all these white guys walking around here do. And I'll tell you something else. Until Democrats quit contemplating their navels and thinking that everybody in the world is going to sit around, suck their thumbs, and say kumbaya, until they show with action, we're going to lose every election from here on out. And that's my biggest fear.
Yeah.
We have the opportunity to be either virtuous or vicious. And look what the Democrats...
I don't think those are our only two alternatives, Tim. And I think that, you know, Mallory McWhat's-her-name, the McMorrow, young woman from in the Michigan State Senate who got up and just raised holy hell. She's now a media phenomenon precisely because, and for the same reason that AOC is and Bernie Sanders are, that we are beginning in our society to celebrate truth tellers, people who will tell the unvarnished truth and will tell it bluntly and use, you know, and raise their voice to do it. And
why is it
I'm seeing more of that happening.
I don't think you can just say
the Democrats.
Why can't they ever ask Republicans a question like, hey, have you ever paid for an abortion? Do you know anybody who's paid for an abortion? How come Trump never got asked that question? How come we never asked that question of any of the Republicans that are running for office?
I don't know that nobody is asking that question. And again, I would say that there are Democrats who are taking these things on. There are Democrats who are, you know, very forward looking. There are also Democrats who have sold out. There are Democrats who are timid. There are Democrats who are just kind of hiding under a rock. And, you know, I get all that stuff. And I think that, you know, we need to move forward. We absolutely need to move forward. Tim, thank you for your call. Joe in Parker, Colorado. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
All right. Well, not buying the UFO thing.
Okay.
The universe has a speed limit, the speed of light. It's 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. So at the speed of light, it takes 50,000 years for a beam of light to cross the Milky Way galaxy from one side to the other. Now, if you're going to travel from one planet to another, you need to get there as fast as possible. And that means at the speed of light, it's going to take slightly more than 4 years to get to the nearest star.
Right.
Now, we got a problem when it comes to relativity, because...
as you get closer to the speed of light, your mass starts expanding exponentially.
Yeah, until you get to the speed of light.
Until it becomes infinite, yeah, at the speed of light.
Right. So, fuel and more fuel is going to mean that the ship's heavier.
Yep.
So you're going to need more fuel.
No, I get the physics of it, or at least the Einsteinian physics of it. I think the assumption is that, you know, as I said earlier, it's like you and I having this conversation is like, you know, a couple people sitting around in the late 1700s saying, hey, you think there'll ever be a time that the words and pictures can go through the air from one side of the planet to the other instantaneously? Nah, there's no way.
Well, words and pictures do not travel from one side of the planet to the other instantaneously.
They appear to.
Well, they're
traveling at the speed of light anyway.
Yeah.
You know, which is close enough to instantaneous for most people. But I get what you're saying, and you're absolutely right. The speed of light is a speed limit for the universe, as it were. Joe, thanks a lot for the call.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And welcome back. Okay, just wanted to flag this for you. You know, every now and then you come across one of these stories and go, whoa. And this was one of them. This is from the telegraph.co.uk. The governor of the Bank of England, his name is Andrew Bailey. He has warned of, quote, apocalyptic, his word, not mine, apocalyptic global food price increases, and said he is, again, his word, helpless in the face of surging inflation as the economy is battered by the war in Ukraine. This is what Tim Wallace writes over at telegraph.co.uk. Food prices are rising at the fastest rate in 30 years. He says he's increasingly concerned about a further surge in food costs if Ukraine, which is one of the world's major crop growers. I think most Americans don't understand the scale of this. Ukraine is the size of Texas. I mean, just let that sink in for a little bit. Ukraine is the size of Texas, except in Texas, there's not a lot that they can grow. There's large chunks of Texas that are basically desert. That's not the case in Ukraine. All of Ukraine, or most all of Ukraine, is like Indiana. I mean, it's like, you know, fertile soil and deep soil and good crops. And they produce a large chunk of the world's wheat and the world's cooking oils. And the Russians have embargoed their ports. They are, you know, preventing ships from going into Ukraine, to these southern Ukrainian ports like Odessa, preventing ships from going in to pick up these crops and transport them to the parts of the world that, you know, typically Ukraine has exported to that desperately need them. And as a result, there is a growing crisis of food. And, you know, in the wealthy world, we're all going to see this as an increase in the price of foods. But in the developing world, you're going to see it as famine. Because many of these countries simply don't have the money to buy food. And that, and even before it becomes famine, it'll probably play out in many of these places like it did, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? I forget how long ago it was that in Tunisia, you had a street vendor who was so upset about the increasing price of wheat, and again, this was because of climate change, driving the desert south and wiping out in Syria and Tunisia and Libya, wiping out the small-scale farmers as the desert came south, that these farmers were showing up in Syria, they were showing up in Damascus, demanding that the government provide some housing and food for them because they literally had to leave their farms because they'd been consumed by sand. And this street vendor in Tunisia who was selling falafels and stuff lit himself on fire as a protest against the rising prices, making it impossible for him to make a living. And that tipped off, or whatever, however you'd say it, the Arab Spring. So, number one, I mean, the governor of the Bank of England is warning about apocalyptic food shortages. I would say this is going to go way beyond that. This is also going to be an apocalyptic political moment. This is what the governor said. The actual quotes from the governor of the Bank of England, he said, "The risk, I'm going to sound rather apocalyptic, I guess, is food. Ukraine does have food in store, but we can't get it out of the country at the moment. We have no way of shipping it out as things stand, and it is getting worse. That is a major worry, and it's not just a worry for this country." He's talking about the United Kingdom. "It's a major worry for the developing world." And then he goes on to say this again, Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, the equivalent of our Fed chair. He said to forecast 10% inflation and say there's not a lot we can do about 80% of it. "I can tell you it's an extremely difficult place to be. We have to recognize the reality of the situation we face." Amazing stuff. Get ready. Dr. Bay in Hartford, North Carolina. Hey, Dr. Bay, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, and it's Hartford, but just call it the Albemarle Sound. I have to take you to task because we keep leaving the big gorilla in the room. It's when people say white supremacy, it's not white supremacy. It's rich, colorless supremacy. And all the things you see rolling out have to do with those who have the power to make things happen. And you can talk about the psychopaths who do things, but where do they get these ideas from? They get the ideas. Tucker Carlson is being paid lots of money to do what he does.
Yep.
Okay, so this is all in together. The issues about food, why do people in a place like Africa, which was the breadbasket of the world for a very long time, have to go and get wheat from Ukraine? Those questions need to be asked, and people can get involved by helping many of those communities to do what they do, sending money, but they're being suppressed by those who have the most money, who have the most interest. And so when we talk about CRT, no one says CRT, put it together with your GRT. Because the truth is, Europeans and those of European ancestry, you're less than 15% of the population of the world.
I thought it was less than that.
If you're looking at it that way, you're always under duress because you are not dominant in your... Your phenotype is the only thing we're really talking about here.
Right.
Your phenotype is not dominant. So we're talking about money. And everything that's been done in Africa and all the other places around the world because they have the resources.
Well, once you start talking about phenotypes, you're conflating money with that. And what we're really talking about is an elite, a system, a worldwide system that was created arguably 400 or 500 years ago. A worldwide system to control the economics of the planet for the benefit of one particular racial group.
No, it's not the racial group. See, that's where people get confused. It's not a racial group because they're not trying to control it for you, Tom. They use race as just a lever to make other people of European ancestry buy into something when the same thing was done to them in Europe.
But the fact of the matter is, Dr. Bay, there are only, I believe there are only three or four, maybe five or six black billionaires in America. I mean, it's all around the world. Go ahead.
Yes, but that is not, that's in America, but that is not, that's how you get people like Idi Amin to do what he does. Because now he rolls into that, quote-unquote, that class. Yes, it was started. We're not going to argue that point because you're right.
Yeah.
It was started by Europeans, the doctrine of discovery.
Which
was a manifestation of all the avarice of the European, quote-unquote, conquerors. And they said this is the reason why.
So,
and the church did this.
So we just have 20 seconds before we hit this hard break. What do we do about this?
The education piece, the CRT, and when everybody starts, you know, getting on that, the Democrats, many of them are being paid off. And they're not willing to change where they're at because they're happy, they're comfortable. And this has a lot to do with it. People are comfortable, and they don't think it's going to happen to them. They're not worried about so-called black people or any other kind of people because it's blackness.
Yeah.
They don't care about that. They're getting paid, and that goes for Herschel Walker. He's getting paid. Tim Scott, he's getting paid.
Yeah.
Off we go.
I get it. I get it. Dr. Bay, thank you. Bob in Desert Hot Springs, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to get your opinion and make a comment. I don't know why Fox is allowed to call themselves a news channel. They're just an opinion channel.
Well, there's nobody who is an arbiter of what is and isn't news. So that's
okay.
That's how they, you know, it's just branding.
Okay. Fair enough, Tom. But I did want to ask you, I remember back in the 60s, they used to have commercials, and I think they were government commercials, where they sponsored Brotherhood, they sponsored Reading. I remember the slogan for Reading was, the more you learn, the more you earn.
Or Reading is fundamental. Those were from the Ad Council. And what the Ad Council did, which was funded by the advertising industry in part, there may have been government grants in there as well, but because radio and television stations couldn't always sell all their advertising inventory, they had to have something to fill that empty space with, and the ad council would come up with these ads. And so typically when you saw those ads, it was because they couldn't sell the space. If this was pre-1987, occasionally radio and television stations would use those ads to fulfill their public service requirements, although typically they did that with news and local announcements, you know, the church bake sale will be Thursday, that kind of stuff. But that's where that came from, Bob.
Okay, fair enough. Why doesn't the president or the Democratic Party put those commercials on TV and promote love?
Well, they're still out there. I mean, I've been watching TV here, and I'm seeing ads for, you know, don't drive drunk. I'm seeing PSAs that have come out of some group here in Oregon that are, you know, state specific, you know, don't text and drive, stuff like that. They're still out there.
And I see a little bit on CNN. They advertise, you know, we only deal with facts.
Right, but typically it's when they can't sell an ad, sadly. I mean, you know, it's, you know.
Okay, but, you know, we have a big issue today. We need to promote love. Love will always outduel hate. And then they're winning the game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Running ads that are promoting, you know, the flip side of racism, I guess. That's a good point. Okay, thank you very much, Bob. That's a great idea. Charles in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. While waiting on hold here, I've been looking at my ballot, which I was planning on dropping off later today. I was very disillusioned, though, upon perusing it as a nonpartisan voter. It really does leave us out of the loop on almost anything.
Do you have closed primaries in Washington State or open primaries?
This is Oregon.
Oh, you're in Oregon. So, oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. Coos Bay. Yeah. So we have closed primaries here. So are you registered as an independent? You didn't get.
I'm not registered under any party affiliation. So
the ballot you got was basically just for the non-political positions like judges and things.
Correct. Now, five of those six judges are running unopposed, so those votes seem pretty meaningless to me. Yeah. The two county commissioner positions, allegedly nonpartisan, are involving some of the most partisan politicians I've ever encountered in my life. And on looking at it, there's really only two positions that have any relevance to me, the county clerk and the commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries, which I guess is better than nothing, but it does feel me kind of left out of the loop. And I think the origins of this, what I was doing on hold is I kind of was trying to figure out the origins, and I think it goes back to 1929, the beginning of the end of what was a hopeful growing democracy. And that's when the House capped the number at 435. And when I found this out, I was blown away that there were a series of about six or seven votes between 1910 and 1929 that capped when we had a population of about 122 million, it capped the number in the House at 435, which is still the number today at a population of 330 million. How is this a representative democracy when that one-to-citizen ratio has been so far expanded? We should have 1,100 people in our House of Representatives, not 435.
Well, based on the metrics of the 1920s. I mean, India has the world's largest parliament, but that doesn't mean that they're any less vulnerable to a demagogue like Modi. Charles, I get your point. I don't have an easy solution for it, and I guarantee you they're not gonna change the number of representatives any day soon. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. This is a game you've got to play, and you can't play if you're not registered to vote. So make sure you're registered to vote. Make sure everybody you know is registered to vote. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. Be good to yourself and the people around you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.